Tonight, our Dharma talk will be given by Senior Dharma Teacher and Senior Priest Diane Fitzgerald.
So lovely to be sitting with you here tonight. And the case I'm going to talk about is case 33 in the collection we call Transmitting the Light, or the Denko Roku. And here's the case. The 33rd patriarch, China's 6th patriarch, was Zen Master Hui Nong. He worked in the rice hulling shed at Huangmei. Once, Zen Master Daman, or Hongren, entered the shed and asked, "Is the rice white yet?" The master answered, "It's white, but it hasn't been sifted yet." Daman struck the mortar 3 times with his staff. The master shook the sifting basket 3 times and entered the patriarch's room. And then to read the poem that Zen Master Keizan, who compiled this collection, he appends a poem to each one of these cases, which are always so lovely. This is one of my favorites. And it goes, "The sound of striking the mortar is loud beyond the empty sky. The white moon is sifted by the clouds, and the evening is deep and serene." So this case here with Hui Nong, the 6th ancestor, such a venerable ancestor in our Zen tradition, Hui Nong was the subject of an earlier talk during this Anga, or the coming and going Sesshin, as we are affectionately calling it. And David gave a lovely talk about Hui Nong. And mostly we focused on the part of Hui Nong's life after he had received from the master the transmission of the robe and the bowl. So a little bit about the story. So Hui Nong was an illiterate woodcutter, and his widowed mother and he lived together, and just by luck, he was out delivering wood, and he happened to hear the Diamond Sutra. And upon hearing it, he was, shall we say, greatly inspired. And with this inspiration, he went to look for a monastery to study the way. And he came upon the monastery at Huangmei, and the master there, Huang Bo. Hongren, yes, said to him, So why do you want to come here?" And he said, "I just want to be a Buddha." And so the patriarch, sent him to the rice hulling shed, where he was left there for 8 months doing nothing but hulling and sifting rice. So no teishos for him, no sutra services, just hulling the rice. And as the story goes on, the patriarch recognized something in him that was just, you know, the glimmer of an eye that one teacher to one student can transmit. And in an instant, Hui Nong revealed himself in the course of the patriarch had a sort of a contest for the monks at the monastery, because he knew it was time for him to transmit the Dharma. And he invited everyone to compose a verse to show their understanding. And so there was kind of a competition, and the senior monk composed one verse and Hui Nong another, and ultimately the patriarch found Hui Nong's more attuned to the true Dharma. And so at that point, the patriarch sent Hui Nong off into hiding because he knew that all of the there would be jealousy, and that is much of what we talked about. How there was a monk Ming who was a great general, and he chased after Huainong because he, you know, was searching for the robe and the bowl, and you know, just couldn't believe that it could have been given to this illiterate worker from the rice hulling mill. And ultimately he chased him through the woods and finally found him, and there was the robe and the bowl on a rock, and Monk Ming couldn't lift them. And he sort of collapsed and said, you know, I haven't come here for the robe and the bowl. I've come here for the Dharma. And it was such, we all, I think, just fell in love with Monk Ming, with his dedication and his intention. And I think this case that I've read to you has a lot to say about intention and something about trying and maybe something about permission. And so with the intention, we have the example of Monk Ming, you know, someone who with great zeal chases after the Dharma. And there are many people like that. One of my favorite teachers actually might be someone who has described herself as a dog with a bone in her mouth once when she got the taste of the Dharma. And I know there are others like that too. And so important to form this intention. And it really is just kind of a miracle how it happens. Kind of the way Huainong, it was a miracle. He just happened to be out on the street delivering his wood and heard the Diamond Sutra, and to him, you know, suddenly an intention is formed. And for him it was a little simpler, you know, I just want to be a Buddha. And I think my situation was less like Monk Ming and without sounding too brash, you know, more like Huainong. I remember the first time I went to a sesshin, it was in upstate New York, and I drove there to the parking lot, and there was a car in the parking lot that had been completely covered in chicken wire. You know that metal wiring you put around chicken coops? And the wiring went around the front and the back of the car and over the top of it, and it was just a great big mess of chicken wire all over the car. And I drove up, and I really had no idea why someone would do that to their car. And I didn't realize anything about a sesshin at that point. And whenever I think about intention, that image of that car wrapped in chicken wire comes to my mind. So someone had great intention to come and stay at that monastery and knew that if he or she had a change of heart, that it was going to take a long time to unravel that chicken wire. I often thought, like, you couldn't use wire cutters because that would scratch the car. So, you know, you'd really have to spend some time getting it undone, and maybe by then you would be willing to go back in. And so when I went there, I was alone. I didn't know anybody there. And I went in, and I was like the worst new Zen student you could imagine, in that, you know, I went to the head monk and I told him I needed a private room. I'm embarrassed to say that. And they just looked at me like, "Where are you from?" And I was so insistent that they actually did give me a private room. But the reason I wanted a private room was not so much that I was thinking I was going to a spa or something, but I had a dear friend at the time, and her husband had just died of cancer after a long illness, and she had all of these medical bills and multiple insurance companies, and there were creditors coming, and I was helping her straighten this out, and it was really a massive effort. And I had thought, well, I'm going on this retreat, I'll just bring everything with me and I'll work in the room, you know. and so this is where I come to the part about permission. And it was really, I didn't give myself permission to just be at this retreat, to make this a priority. Somehow, like Ming, I had heard something and I was called to come there. And I did want to become a Buddha. But I just didn't give myself permission to fully engage and realize that this is a priority, and I should honor that. And so often I think that maybe we don't allow ourselves that, you know, we think we need to follow along some idea of who we should be. We should be helpful, we should be nice, we should be pleasing, you know, we should keep up with our work. And so just to honor this intention that we all bring here, and honor it in the way of giving ourselves permission to fully engage with this practice. And so during this Ango, we've talked a little bit about near enemies and how kind of insidious they can be, because we don't always notice them because they're so close. And to me, the near enemy of intention can be trying. And yes, you know, trying, maybe it's just inevitable that we all have to engage in that way of trying, that way that we have learned so well since early childhood, that this is how you go about making the rice white. You try to do it. This is how you go about becoming a Buddha. You try. This is how you get the robe and the bowl. You try. And it brings to mind the other part of the story of Huineng, where the poetry contest, you know, and the senior monk in the monastery, his poem was, "The body is the tree of enlightenment. The mind is like a bright mirror stand. Wipe it clean over and over, and do not let the dust gather." And so, you know, that speaks to us, you know, that we are always feeling that we need to keep dusting and keep cleaning, and if with all of our trying, you know, maybe that will work. Maybe the rice will whiten with our own personal effort. And Huineng's poem was, "Enlightenment is essentially not a tree. The bright mirror is not a stand. From the beginning, not a single thing exists. Where can the dust collect?" And so this to me speaks of the permission to honor this intention that we bring to our practice, and the spaciousness of it, and the loving entrustment of it. I think Keizan said it best with his poem. "The sound of striking the mortar is loud beyond the empty sky. The white moon is sifted by the clouds, and the evening is deep and serene." So the white moon is sifted by the clouds. Without any intention, the clouds sift the moon. Without any intention, our lives sift us. Everything that happens, sifting us constantly. And our practice, without any trying, sifts us. Thank you.
Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue now. So what happens at this point is that we get a chance to ask questions, make comments about the talk or about anything that's coming up for us in practice. Yes.
I really like your voice.
Thank you.
Nice to listen. And I want to ask, I'm sorry we were late. And,
it's okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't miss the beginning, but so when you say trying, sometimes trying is not enough.
Mm. And sometimes not, and sometimes too much, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But if the intent, so without an intention, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we have to allow ourselves to be there in order for something to happen. But it's almost accidental.
Yeah. That's lovely. Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think that captures it perfectly.
So I would have mm-hmm. to be there to allow the accident.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have said it better.
You heard just enough of the talk. You got the whole thing right there. That was the essence point of it.
But I think too, Diane, you actually talked about intention both ways. Mm-hmm. You talked about we shouldn't try, and that intention is important. And then at the end also said, how lovely, how everything just happens even without intention. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. probably true both ways, that mm-hmm. some intention to be here, to mm-hmm. show up is required. Mm-hmm. And yet if we think through the power of our intention, we can make it happen. We miss, I love, the clouds are sifting the moon, and our lives are just sifting us. Mm-hmm. Each one of us being cooked.
Can you give a synonym for sifting?
Oh, sifting. Oh, it's like, you know, when you make a cake and you have to sift the flour, you know, with the holes, right? So he was sifting the rice. That was his job. He was supposed to be hulling the rice, threshing the rice to get it to be white rice.
So taking off the outside covering and letting the rice go through and keeping the covering.
I know the Romanian word for that. But
yes. Okay. What is the Romanian word for that?
Sita.
Oh, so it's the same root. Same root.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sita.
Yes, it's Latin.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is... I love that the clouds sifting the moon. Mm-hmm. You know, that there is... Wei Nung's teaching is so clearly, and Kaizen's teaching in this collection is so clearly pointing to already accomplished, just what Claudia is pointing to as well, already here, but you still have to show up for it. You can't just, you know, you can't just sit by the side of the road and think you're going to get home. You actually have to go home. Mm-hmm. So there is this, home's waiting here, it's been her the whole time, and we have to walk towards it. And it's very subtle, the distinction between mm-hmm. intending and trying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I love the phrase near enemy to describe the difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your talk. I'm a little stuck on the word sifting. Sifting to me means separating. So what are we separating in our life? What are we...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the answer.
Two student of the way.
but I think nice to be caught. You know, it's easy to go, oh yeah, sifting, that's really cool, I really get it. And you're like really looking at it, say, well, yeah, maybe not. Maybe you want to write another poem. No sifting necessary is the next Dharma talk to correct this Dharma talk. You know? But, so, you know, nice to, right, it doesn't fixate like that. And I think nice to notice that. What do you mean, sifting?
Does it suggest something to you?
Sifting, you said at the end, sifting our lives. Sifting, looking.
Mm-hmm.
And sifting suggests separating. So, separating the wheat from the chaff, of separating the husk from the rice.
Separating what you want to do with your life from what you don't want to do.
Keep something else. That's what comes to mind. I know that can't be right.
But you know, there is something that, thank you for clarifying where you're stuck, because there's a lot of wisdom in it, at least from where I'm sitting. And the crux of this whole thing for me is that we're already enlightened. We're already Buddhas. The rice is already white rice. It's all done. The moon is shining. All set. But that's obscured often by our ideas and our stories about ourselves. So even though those things too are the enlightened mind, heart, still they confuse us and they get in our way. So we have to practice. And the moon's already full. And how do you take those two things and put them together? You know, the mind goes, whoa! And that's not a bad place for the mind to be. Whoa!
So perhaps the sifting could be more like filtering or refining?
Refining, yeah.
Filtering, refining. Clarifying, kind of? I don't know, maybe.
All of those. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yes, right.
One of the images sometimes we use when we're on retreat is like we're all these kind of rocks that are kind of pointy and jagged, and together we like all tumble together and we get a little more rounded, you know, it's like we're not so... So, not quite sifting, but to me kind of the same activity, you know.
Mm-hmm. And there is work to be done. Mm-hmm. I think we all know in our own lives how often we get lost, and on one hand no progress and already here from the beginning, but unless we really put ourselves into this and clarify the matter, we just wander through our life, we miss it.
And it sort of speaks to me of sort of, you know, one thing becoming another thing, you know, moo becoming moo, right? That even if it does sort of arise as separation, you know, mu arising as separation. This experience of the rice being one way and then becoming another way, right? And we all do that as well. And in some ways, that's sort of my experience of the vividness of the moment, right? Becoming and becoming and becoming.
Troublemaker.
So far, everybody's correct.
Yeah.
I think from, you know, what I hear from Mike too is, you know, there's that sometimes that feeling of, we're practicing to get somewhere. So, like, you know, sifting the rice where somehow the white rice is better than the other. And, you know, so there's something to, you know, to see is like how we say, oh, this is good, this is bad. And so maybe just seeing that can be something. You know? But, and I really liked what you talked about intention in your story of going to your first sesshin, you know. Because, I mean, it seems to be really hard to do anything without intention. You know, I mean, it's... Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there's always intention. Mm-hmm. So, kind of, you know, how you see that and how, I guess, you know, you move with intention and then action happens and then you just kind of see what happens. And learn from that. And so then, you know, seeing, you know, attaching to results. Like, you know, for me, right now, I'm doing a lot of sewing. And, you know, it's like, it's there's a lot of intention of so many straight lines, you know. And then look, and it's not straight. You know, so then there it is, like, you know, straight. It's not straight, and you know. So do I go back and fix it? You know, that's where I'm at. You know, or do I just keep going? You know, so there's it's that constant kind of.
Yeah, you should see how my recluse is coming out.
Yeah, just kind of, you know, that's it. An example.
Yeah, he's sewing a super ruksu. He's sewing his monk's ropes, his priest's ropes. So it is the pattern you're following, but it's huge. imagine that being endless ruksu. So I think I saw Steve and then Matt and then Ray. And we'll get to Claire.
Sorry, I forget your name.
I'm Aaron.
What you said about sewing the monk's robe goes with also some thought I had about the winnowing, the sifting, because you do something with intention, the row isn't straight, you're sifting, you just notice the row isn't straight, you sift it, but it isn't that you then throw away the row, or you, the things that you have sifted somehow are taken and put somewhere else. I mean, the thing that happens to me is I understand something more about myself, but the thing that I've sifted out doesn't then disappear or go somewhere else. It's still part of me. It's been sifted, but it's still there.
I think that's nice. Thank you.
So the you know, jagged lines when you're trying to sew reminded me of the concept of a spirit stitch. It's used in certain Native American cultures, but also the Amish do it and several others, where you always put an intentional mistake in when you make something, just so it isn't perfect. And I also knit, so in the knitting world, you know, you knit, and if you make a mistake, it's like, oh, that's a spirit stitch. So you don't have to go back and fix it. It's okay.
And can you do all spirit stitches?
Some days.
Some days.
That's good.
I've heard that before, but I never quite got it until you said it tonight, Matt. Thank you for that. I remember studying the music of some Southern African group, and I can't remember their name right now, but they play the thumb piano, the kalimba or marimba, I guess kalimba is what it's called, and they play these patterns, and there's a certain point inevitably where they make a mistake in the pattern, and that becomes the new pattern. Mm-hmm. Then they have to learn that, the one with the mistake in it, because there are no mistakes, it's just another pattern. And then they play it for a long time, and then they make another mistake, and then that's the next pattern. And when you listen to the music, you can hear that forward progression. It's kind of improvisational. It always starts with something intended, but it ends up in this completely other place, which feels really familiar to me.
In this line, I enjoyed your talk very much, and I usually enjoy these talks. They're wonderfully pointers to something. Then I realized, God, how stupid I am. Of course, I missed it completely. It's perfect for me because I was going down the path of seeking something and trying to get something. So then I come back and but this continuously being pointed, for me, it feels like that I'm missing, you know, the obvious, or what's before me. And I can see it in some way that way is the way that is, you know, offers more freedom from suffering than, you know, being stuck in my searching and my trying, if you will, or trying to get someplace I can see that one will not get me anywheres. And yet, I can't, and maybe this is the thing about trying, I can't get outside my conditioning. The next thing I know, I'm back into my old habit again. And I hear a wonderful talk, get some clarity for a few moments. Right back into my own. And I feel powerless to step out of my old habits in terms of my behavior, intellectually, if it is so. But I can't step out of it. And so, you know, then my project, if you will, looks like being with that.
Hallelujah.
Just that's yeah. That's hard.
Yeah.
For me, that's the work. That's you know, wherever it is.
Well, to me, that's what Suzuki Roshi was talking about when he said the spiritual life is one mistake after another. But I think you articulate it so well, because in our minds, you know, we hear a talk as, oh, sifting. Oh, I really get it now. I am a changed man. unless we look closely, we don't see that then I create the sifting persona. And I just use the new content to do the old thing, the same old thing I've done forever and ever. And I think this pain of lack of will, you know, when we see the depth of this conditioning and we long to break free and we despair, will I ever? Is there any way? But, you know, then you say, well, this is the project, to notice it, to see this happening. Yeah. Wow, thank you, Ray. That was really... I'm inspired. I'm changed.
We'll see you tomorrow morning. but that's... there's a slight... I want to just put a subtle twist on this one, because when you see these patterns, you know, when you're in the throes of them, the seeing itself actually subtly shifts the pattern. It's like those African musicians again. And it seems like you're the same person that you were, and you're doing the same, running the same shtick and caught again. But you're actually not, because life doesn't really repeat itself. It endlessly moves forward into something new. And so everything you said was true, and it's not so hopeless as it feels from the inside, from the outside especially. It's like, huh? Wow, look. And that, I think that's really, it's so subtle, because then if we say, yeah, great, I am changing, I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago, and I'm not the same person I was yesterday. And yet, I still enact those patterns. And yet, right? Could you feel that? Yeah. And I know that about you as well. Just a little, from the outside. It's kind of reassuring. Also, I heard that quote from Suzuki Roshi differently, as one humiliation after another. Because for me, that actually bites more. Because it's not just that I make mistakes. I make mistakes constantly, you know, from the moment I wake up to the moment I mistake. But then there's this extra twist. Oh, I wish I hadn't done that. That's where I think some learning happens, if we can just get beyond that too. Of course I did that. Now what? What's the new pattern?
So I really like what Ray's pointing to here, because it really matches, you know, my own experience of, you know, finding myself seemingly stuck over and over again in the same sort of personality things that, you know, are kind of like basically inherent for me, you know, and I so much want to change them, you know, and I think, you know, through this seeing that you're talking about, that really can be so powerful, and I think that for me, I'm at least beginning to realize that the goal can be more about, you know, kind of being okay with the way that I am, rather than this certainty that I need to fix how I am in order to get somewhere, you know, I think, you know, that isn't actually true for any of us. You know, if we could only be more comfortable with where we already are, that would make all the difference, and that we can get some of that comfort just by, you know, seeing over and over again. But it's a difficult thing. These patterns are so ingrained, you know, and difficult to work with. And as someone, I think maybe it was David that said it isn't actually the same thing, or maybe with you, Melissa, that it's, you know, it's close enough so that it rhymes quite strong.
Yeah, yeah.
And looks, say, yeah, we don't even want to examine it because it seems so familiar, right, you know. Right. And if we really intend, I'm big on intention, so, if we set the intention to look, you know, and actually be willing to be with ourselves, I think it can make a tremendous difference when we begin to realize that we don't need to fix ourselves the way that we think.
Well, it goes, for me, it goes back to the clouds sifting the moon. You know, the every person in here is caught in some way. We're all caught in these endless repeating patterns of behavior and thinking and judging, and if we, as you're saying, you didn't use the word befriend, you used another word, accept.
Accept.
But I think, you know, accept, befriend, like get okay with it in a way. Right. This horrible, humiliating meanness, M-E-N-E-S-S. Then our gifts to the world are released, because every single person has a completely unique way of expressing the Dharma, of being helpful in the world, of being someone who saves all beings. But we can't do that until we stop trying to be some other person, because the trying to be some other person gets in the way. And then we get to be just completely Steve, Aaron, Ray, Diane, etc.
And it's so much easier to see that about other people.
Oh, yeah.
You go, well, Ray, I mean, look at what happened to this fucking game. Wow, that's really crazy.
Steve doesn't need to change.
No.
Diane's fine.
Steve's fine.
James is fine.
That's
the spirit stitch.
Yeah, the spirit stitch. The spirit stitch.
That's good.
It's completely made up of spirit stitches.
The spirit stitch is I have to tell you, David, and you, Aaron, that it is possible to do nothing but spirit stitches.
Right?
I took my Okesa to Shisha Warner, and she looked at it and she went, "You sewed this by hand, didn't you?" And I went, "Yes." And she went, "That's really lovely. And you'll be really happy to have done this, but I have to tell you that every stitch was backwards."
Nice.
Everyone. Thousands of them. And there it is. And it's lovely. I just, you know, it. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I do have a question, though. I love the part about things happening without intention, and I'm baffled by intention. I mean, I know everyone, you know, there's been a lot of talk in favor of it, or saying that it's something that people feel actually happens, and there's a part of me that thinks it's just a story I tell myself. You know, when I was a small child, I was given a bow and arrow. And I remember sitting in the basement with my brother and taking the bow and aiming it at the wall and firing the arrow into the wall and turning to my brother and going, "That's exactly where I meant to be." That's my intention for tools like that. It's you know, a story I tell myself afterwards.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really right on. Yeah.
And the other side is, you came here. You didn't go somewhere else.
That's true. But
and we may not be able to articulate our intention. And I think this inexpressible something is calling to us. And so I think you knew something clearly enough to do everything you had to do to fly across the country to make 3 weeks. So it's not always that we're conscious of our intention, but we all are making choices every day. Am I going to give time to this, or will I give time to that? And I think when we can know in some way, and it may be clear or not clear, what do we want to give our life to, that we can move toward awakening. We can move toward a way of being in the world. And I think it is important, and it not just, we can say it about the specific, and I think if we get too concrete, you know, oh, I meant to be here, we don't know. But I think everybody here, to some degree, has something that calls us. Otherwise, we wouldn't do this. So that's the other side.
I think you're both right. So why don't we sit for another few moments?